Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Where is the line between the weak and the strong in any conflict or competition, and how do long shot players ever prevail? As my guest today will explain, conventional wisdom about who is likely to emerge on top only goes so far. Last night's Super Bowl outcome notwithstanding, we all know stories of those not expected to do great things who nevertheless find their way to victory. And it turns out many of them get discounted too early because apparent strength can come with hidden hindrances and apparent weakness can mask the presence of advantages like creativity, flexibility, and grit. Author Malcolm Gladwell explores all of this in his latest book, David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. He's in town to speak tonight to Arts and Letters Live at the McFarlane Auditorium at SMU. Malcolm, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
Most people know the story of David and Goliath, right? Little David in his slingshot takes on this angry behemoth. No one thinks David is going to win. And he doesn't just survive, but he does, in fact, win. Mm-hmm. How do we misunderstand the odds going into that?
Well, because for several reasons, the story turns out to be far more complex than it appears. We've told it in a very sort of strange way, and I begin my book by retelling it. And the first thing to point out is that because we live in the modern age, we've forgotten what an extraordinary weapon a sling is. A sling is just about the most devastating weapon in ancient times. The rock that leaves David's sling has the stopping power that's equivalent to a 38 caliber handgun. The sling was also, when they were experienced as David was, were incredibly accurate. The Bible talks about the extraordinary accuracy of slingers on more than one occasion. So that's number one. David has superior technology. Once he's made the decision not to bring a sword to a sword fight, but to bring a sling, he's got the upper hand right away. And the second thing that's really kind of fun is that endocrinologists have weighed in on the story of David and Goliath and have suggested that Goliath looks an awful lot like someone suffering from what's called acromegaly, which is a common cause of giantism, and it's a tumor on your pituitary gland which causes the overproduction of human growth hormone, which accounts for his size. But there's a side effect of that, which is that acromegaly often causes severe restrictions in vision. And when you look closely at the story as it's told in Samuel, it's clear that Goliath's got vision problems. He's led onto the valley floor by an attendant, which is weird if he's this big, mighty warrior. And also, why does it take him so long to figure out that David is not going to fight? David comes down from the mountain, from the ridge where all the Israelites are. He's not carrying a sword. He's not carrying a shield. He's not even dressed in armor. And yet, Goliath doesn't respond until the last possible moment, right? It's just crazy. And the answer is, the reason is, Goliath can't see. He can only see a few feet in front of him, which is sort of common with someone suffering from acromegaly. So here we have a guy with superior technology who's nimble and fast coming up against a guy who doesn't realize the rules have been changed and who can't see his opponent. That is not a story of David triumphing against overwhelming odds. And I haven't even mentioned, by the way, that David has the spirit of the Lord in his heart. I mean,
he can't hurt, right?
He can't. I mean, so it's fascinating to me that we have chosen a story like that to emphasize the improbability of an underdog's victory, when in fact, upon close examination, it strikes me anyway that all the balls are in David's court.
Well, I think the brilliance of David is that he realizes, like, mano a mano, he's got no shot, right? Whether Goliath can see well or not, he can land a punch if David is in striking distance. So he decides not to fight the way Goliath decided to fight.
Exactly. Had David fought according to the rules, sword to sword, he's totally going to lose. I mean, there's no way he can defeat Goliath. But that's the thing. And that's number one lesson of underdogs, which is that they win when they, or they have, they improve their chances of winning immeasurably when they choose to defy convention. And a lot of my book is devoted to what that means. And what does it take to be someone who defies convention? Because it would have been everyone else on the Israelite side, it never occurred to them to bring a sling, right? Only David is the one who says, wait a minute, who says I have to fight the way everyone says I have to fight? You know, what if, can't I do that my way? And that's interesting to me. And I have a chapter, for example, in the book about the civil rights movement in Birmingham, Alabama. It's one of my favorite chapters in the book. And it's all about what happened when King and his deputy, Wyatt Walker, went up against Bull Connor. And there was a case where they were completely outgunned. I mean, Connor, the King was at his lowest ebb. Nobody was signing up for the marches. Bull Connor was in full control of the full power of the city. He didn't have to stand a chance if he went up against him conventionally. He had no political, legal, economic, no power in any of those realms. So what does he do? And that chapter is all about the tricks that the civil rights movement played on Bull Connor. Basically, they pulled the wool over his eyes, which is what you do when you are denied access to all conventional forms of power and authority. And that's the underdog's great potential.
How does having the power, holding the traditional sources of power, tend to cause us to become blind like Goliath?
Yeah, I mean, I talk about this. I mean, a good half of the book is devoted to Goliath. I'm not just talking about underdogs. I'm also interested in this very question, which is, for underdogs to win, giants must also blow it. So Goliath, in a certain sense, blows it. It never occurs to him to protect himself against someone who chooses not to play by the rules. So I have a chapter about insurgency in this book, and it's all about the Northern Ireland, what happened in Northern Ireland. Why did the British, one of the strongest and mightiest armies in the world, how is it they were fought to a standoff for 30 years by a group of several hundred IRA insurgents in Northern Ireland? It doesn't make any sense. I mean, it's crazy. But then again, it's no more crazy than the fact that the United States was fought to a standoff and ultimately lost to a group of insurgents in Viet Cong who were equally overwhelmed and outgunned. Or even if you look at what's gone on in Afghanistan over the last 15 years, 10 years, or actually over the last 30 years, or I could even say over the last several hundred years, where time and time again, this extraordinarily primitive society has defeated much more powerful foes. And there's a bunch of reasons, but I was really interested in this question about how that giants are subject to much closer scrutiny than underdogs. You're held to a higher standard. And when Goliaths act illegitimately, when they mistreat, when they do not treat those who they are attempting to govern with respect and fairness, they can generate a kind of backlash that is almost impossible to overcome. That's what's going on in Northern Ireland, is that the Catholics of Northern Ireland are angry. And anger turns out to be something, that emotion and all the emotions that come with it, turn out to give people the motivation to keep fighting long past the point that the so-called strong power wants to fight. That's what happens in Vietnam. They outlast us. Why? Because they have a more at stake emotionally. Same with what happens in Northern Ireland, is that they just won't give up, right? British keep wanting to go home and don't get to go home. And finally, they just will do anything to stop the conflict. And that's a kind of that notion that persistence at the end of the day can defeat material advantage is one that we always forget, right? You know, the thing that should have been said in this country before we went into Afghanistan was, and there were lots of people who knew this just by looking at what happened with the Soviet Union and before that with the British, that we should have had a conversation in this country which said, we think it is important for the following reasons to go in and fight in Afghanistan, but let's be clear that if we are going to win this conflict, it's going to take many, many, many years. It's going to be measured in decades, not in months. Are we prepared to fight that long?
And I suppose the issue there was that we had no experience with anything that took that long. I mean, even Vietnam has been dwarfed now in duration by the events in Afghanistan.
Yeah. No, I mean, although I would say that those people who lived through and fought in Vietnam, they knew. I mean, I think we just weren't listening to them. I think Colin Powell, if you'd pulled him aside in 2001, 2002, and said to him, how long will the fight in Afghanistan take? I think he would have said, oh, you can measure it in decades, not. I mean, people who, that's the thing, those who have firsthand experience carry that lesson with them, I think, their whole lives. It's just that so many of us didn't. You know, it was so easy to kind of gloss over that kind of the lessons of that conflict.
We'll talk about this because our narratives, boy, we love an underdog story, right? We love it when, you know, Rudy wins the football championship in the movies, and we love all of these stories. Just because underdogs can win over less nimble, less passionate opponents that seem to have all the power doesn't mean that it's always good triumphing over evil. It can go both ways.
Oh, yeah. No, in fact, I mean, I, in this book, chose to focus on largely on underdogs who I thought were fighting a worthy cause. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the exact same principles are put to use by people who are not fighting what we would consider to be worthy causes. What I'm describing here is a set of principles which are neutral that can be used for good or ill.
So let's talk about advantageous disadvantages. Mm-hmm. This sounds like it's almost Orwellian, but you explained it very nicely. What qualifies, what classifies as an advantageous disadvantage?
So this is this really interesting observation that has been made by psychologists in recent years. And they've pointed out that when you're learning something, and I make the learning task harder, generally speaking, we assume that that makes your ability to learn that thing, it impairs your ability to learn that thing, right? If I give you a textbook that's really, really badly written, it's hard for you to learn calculus, right? If I give you one that's really clear and simple, you'll learn. But they've said, you know what, that is not always true. There are a set of circumstances where if I make your task harder, your learning outcome will improve. It will cause you to do any number of things, to work harder, to focus more, to be more persistent, to think through the problem better. And they call that class of difficulty, a desirable difficulty. And they distinguish very clearly between undesirable and desirable difficulties. So I was fascinated by that. And because it turns out there are lots of cases in life where difficulties divide into those two groups. The one I spend a whole chapter on is dyslexia.
Yeah.
So dyslexia is fascinating. There are a class of people for whom dyslexia is a true handicap. It makes them much worse off than they would have been otherwise. If you go to prisons around this country, you will find lots and lots and lots of dyslexics, way more than you'll find in the general population. Those are people who have been defeated in some sense by their handicap. But you can also go, if you also get together a group of successful entrepreneurs and ask for a show of hands on who has dyslexia, you'd be stunned by how many will raise their hand. The rates of dyslexia among successful entrepreneurs also far exceed the kind of general population level. And when you talk to those people, they will tell you that they believe they succeeded not in spite of their disability, but because of it. That is fascinating to me. And so I spent a large amount of time talking to successful dyslexics about why did they believe that? What was it about their disability that they felt actually helped them and not impaired them? So I had a long conversation. Part of the chapter is all about is that the music?
It's the music. You can finish this thought, and then we'll come back to this.
I'll
part
come
of the
back. Well, about the conversation that I had with David Boies, the great trial lawyer. He's a good example of this.
We're speaking this hour with author Malcolm Gladwell. His latest book is called David and Goliath: Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. He's in town to speak to Arts and Letters Live tonight. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you: the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Malcolm Gladwell. His latest book is called David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. He's in town to speak tonight to Arts and Letters Live at 7:30 at the McFarland Auditorium at SMU. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. You can email think at kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, Malcolm, before the break, you brought up the desirable difficulty of dyslexia for David Boies.
Oh, yeah. So he's interesting. Here's the greatest trial lawyer in the country, and he's a dyslexic, which, first of all, totally threw me. I mean, how on earth do you get through law school if you have difficulty reading? And so we sat down, had this conversation, and he described how he did it. And he said, well, from the very beginning, the way he got through school was by developing his listening skills, and then also by developing his memory. He didn't read and take notes. He listened intently to the teacher and committed what he heard to memory. And so by the time he hits law school, this is a richly developed skill. And then when he gets into the courtroom, he's famous as a lawyer who on day 4 of the cross-examination says to you, but wait a minute, what you just said contradicted, you know, what you said on day 1, right? Those same skills suddenly become hugely advantageous. And that's the same thing with the dyslexic entrepreneurs, that they get through school by delegating and by communicating orally and by problem solving and by learning how to cope with failure. And all those things, when they go into the business world, those are some of the most important skills necessary to be a successful entrepreneur. So it's fascinating to me how for some people, and it's only some people manage to take what is a hugely significant handicap and turn it around and use it as a way of developing skills they wouldn't otherwise have had.
Well, I gather it would be hard to quantify this, but did you find that it's significant that people are able to make meaning of this disadvantage that they have in their lives, and that's also a factor?
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I found was extraordinary diversity of responses to. So when we talk about dyslexia, we think of that as a single handicap, a single disease or whatever. Mm-hmm. And what I discovered, or my sense from interviewing as many people as I did, was it's not one thing. It's an infinite number of things that people have hugely disparate responses to it. Whether they choose to stress it, whether they choose to ignore it, whether they choose to fight it, whether they choose to succumb to it. I mean, and so it's, we should stop using that term, except in a very, very narrow clinical sense, because it has such a bafflingly large range of outcomes.
So what are the advantages of being a big fish in a small pond?
So this has been the most one of the most kind of controversial of the chapters in the book. I was interested in this question of, if you're a student and you're picking a school, you have a choice, broadly speaking. You can choose to be a little fish in a big pond or a big fish in a little pond. In other words, you can choose to go to the very best school you can get into, the most competitive one, the one where you'll be surrounded by the best students. That's the big pond. And chances are you're not going to stand out, right? Or you can choose to not go to the best school you get into. Just go to a average school where your chances of standing out are much greater, where you'll be a big fish in a little pond. Now, when it comes to college choice or high school choice, the default mode in America is always to go to the biggest pond imaginable, the most prestigious elite school you can get into. Parents tell their kids, go to the best school you can. And the question is that good advice? And the answer is sometimes, but an awful lot of times, no. It's mm-hmm. the worst possible thing you can do. And I looked specifically at science and math education because we have a huge shortage of people with science and math degrees in this country. And that's not because of a lack of interest in science and math. It's because of the dropout rates are so high. We lose so many kids. And the question is, who's dropping out of science and math? And the answer is, it's not the kids who aren't intellectually equipped to handle science and math. Rather, it is in absolutely every science and math program, no matter the level of prestige or selectivity of the school, the kids in the bottom third of the class are dropping out. In other words, it's feeling that you can't. It's feeling dumb that causes you to drop out, not being dumb. The kid in the bottom third of their class at Harvard has as poor a chance of getting a science degree as the kid in the bottom third of their class at, you know, East Mississippi State. So if you're someone who's trying to get a degree in a very competitive field, your best bet is, and we have reams of statistics to show this, is to go to a school where you can be in the top third of your class, right? That's the place where you can feel like you are mastering the material and on top of the world. That's when you'll be able to complete the difficult task of getting a science and engineering degree.
So as all these data begin to emerge and really snowball, why do we continue to see universities chasing those like U.S. News and World Report rankings and similar rankings that exist now, and everybody wants to be at the top of their classification?
Yeah. I don't know. There's a kind of fundamental, I mean, this is one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, because I felt there was a fundamental irrationality in the way that we measure and define advantage in this country. That we have such a kind of narrow list. We're as bad as the Israelites and the Philistines in years and years ago, you know, when Goliath marches on the field, where everyone assumes the only thing that matters in a conflict is how tall and strong you are. No, a whole bunch of other things matter. But somehow they were obsessed with the fact that Goliath was 6'6" and had a huge sword in his hand. And similarly, we're obsessed with such a narrow range of things that we forget sometimes a little adversity helps you. Sometimes prestige hurts you. A prestigious institution ends up making you feel stupid and you can't get the degree you want to get. You know, there's all these kinds of subtle ways in which the picture is more complicated than it appears.
Is there any advantage to artificially creating some hardship for individuals who might, for a variety of reasons, have had everything come pretty easily to them in the past?
That's a really interesting question, and I get into that a little bit in this chapter about what it means to raise a child if you are very wealthy. And I interviewed at length an extremely wealthy man who had made many hundreds of millions of dollars, who became aware as his kids were grown that he, by raising them in such a affluent set of circumstances, he had harmed them. They had never learned the importance of self-reliance, of discipline, value of hard work. They had no chance to kind of go out in the world and achieve for themselves. He had essentially cut their legs off by giving them everything they ever desired without ever working for it. And he would say, absolutely, what I should have done is I should have taken pains to raise my kids in as close as I could to something that resembled the middle-class, resource-constrained upbringing that he had. You know, I don't think he would have bought the huge house that he bought if he'd realized the consequences of it. So I do think, I mean, in that same chapter, I talk a lot about class size and how I think there's clear evidence that classes can be too small, that they start to harm kids when they get below a certain level. There's a case where you don't want to spend every last dollar you can spend on reducing the size of classes. There's a point where you can spend too much money on education and you can rob kids of the, you know, it is not true that a child needs to, that the best outcome for a child is maximizing the amount of attention they get from a teacher. No, up to a certain point, yes. But there comes a point where it is good for a child to have to sit there by themselves and work it out by themselves, right? You don't want the teacher looking over their shoulder every minute of the day. There is a time when that kind of difficulty and adversity is ultimately advantageous because, as we know, in the real world, the teacher isn't looking over your shoulder every minute of the day, right? I think that is something we, particularly as this society grows more and more affluent, or at least some in this society grow more and more affluent, that's absolutely something we need to think about, that we need to sometimes engineer difficulty into desirable difficulty into the situations, particularly that our children find themselves in.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now. We have Lindsay in Dallas on the line. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
So I was just listening to your show talking, and I was really fascinated with what you had to say about dyslexics and how you have those that ended up in jail and then those that ended up being really successful, such as the trial lawyer that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering, as to your opinion on medicating certain learning disabilities, such as ADD or ADHD, and the pros and cons of medicating them, whether you support it or not, because mm-hmm. I know a lot of artists or people that have gone to be successful in their field do have learning disabilities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting question, and really interesting question. I guess the root of that question is the following, which is, do we know, can we tell what kinds of people, for what kinds of people a disability might ultimately be advantageous, and can we distinguish them from those for whom a disability would ultimately not be advantageous? The latter group are the kinds of people that you would want to, if there was a magic pill for dyslexia, mm-hmm. you'd want to give them that pill. The first group, you'd want to think twice about doing it, right? So, you know, this says that we need to do a better job of trying to figure out who are the people who could profit from a little desirable difficulty and who are the people who can't. You know, I was struck when I interviewed all of my successful dyslexics. There were some interesting patterns. They were all, for example, clearly had higher than average intelligence, right? That makes sense. More interestingly, each one of them had someone in their life, a close family member, who always unequivocally believed in them, who never thought of them as having a disability, who treated them as if they were. And that seemed to be really, really crucial in their outcome. And they also didn't have other overlapping problems as well. Mm-hmm. They didn't have, on top of that, did not have, you know, psychological problems or messy family backgrounds. There are ways, I think, where we can sort of separate out those for whom this is not a desirable difficulty and those for whom it is.
I think that's an important point, because if someone were to sort of, assume based on a really cursory reading of this book that this put society off the hook for caring for people who face, significant disadvantages in their lives. And that is not the point you're trying to make.
No,
here.
Not at all. I mean, in fact, I think what it does is it clarifies this argument, clarifies who needs help and who doesn't. I mean, I think that's the big, I mean, one of the things that, one of the great challenges of social policy, I think, in the next generation is to do a much better job of trying to figure that question out. Who deserves and requires our help and who doesn't? And right now, I think we do a very, very crude job of making that distinction. We throw a lot of money at people who don't need it and deprive a lot of people of help who genuinely do need it. And I'm hoping that this kind of discussion gets us smarter about that question.
Certainly, there are many statistics to show that growing up with an absent parent or having lost a parent can be a disadvantage. But you also found, once again, that there's a disproportionate number of quite successful people who have suffered such a loss.
Yeah, this is another thing. Parental loss is even weirder than dyslexia. It is, let's be clear, a small percentage of those who suffer the loss of a parent in childhood end up overachieving as adults. So this is something that is, anecdotally, I went around and started talking to psychiatrists. And if you just sort of talk to psychiatrists who have, seen many patients over the years, they will anecdotally say, oh, yes, it's fascinating. The number of people for whom, who have vastly overachieved as adults who have had this trauma in their childhood. And then statistically, if you look at things like, I used American presidents and English prime ministers, that group, the people who've attained that extraordinary level of career success. They are the number of them who lost a parent in childhood is way higher than the population average, and it raises the same issue, which is there is no question this is about as traumatic a blow as any human being can suffer. Some small percentage of people adapt to that trauma in a way that it's ultimately advantageous. Now, I'm not saying they get over it. I don't think you ever get over that. And I think, one of the observations that was made about this big study of English prime ministers is that as a group, they were some of the most unhappy and traumatized These are not people who are necessarily happier, but they are people who somehow found a way to interpret that tragedy in a form that made them better equipped to climb the ladder in the world that they were competing in. And that's both weird and slightly disturbing and fascinating. And it's the same kind of phenomenon that there's a small percentage for whom these difficulties can be desirable.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to David in Grapevine. Hello, David.
Hi, fascinating show.
Thank you.
Thanks for taking my call. My question is this. I went to one of those U.S. News and World Report highly ranked liberal arts colleges, and I was a history major and got a lot of B's and thought, hey, I'm at a tough school. These are B's. That's great. And then I realized when I graduated and saw my transcript, I was in the bottom third of my class. And so that to me says grade inflation. And I also thought back, you know, if I had gotten some lower grade in some of my core classes, maybe it would have been a wake-up call and I would have worked harder. So I just want to know if you've run into any study on grade inflation and what that might have in terms of the psychology of the students involved. And I'll take the answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, interesting. In my book, my discussion about this phenomenon was specific to science, math, and engineering, where grade inflation is much lower, obviously, because those are tend to be disciplines that are graded on a curve. So when you are at the bottom of your class in those disciplines, you feel it, right? You're very conscious of the fact that and one of the reasons that liberal arts doesn't have the same kind of dire big fish or big pond problem is because of the phenomenon of grade inflation. But I would be really curious to know, as your reader asked, what would happen in those disciplines if they were as rigorous as the science have. And I say this as a liberal arts graduate myself, a beneficiary of grade inflation.
We are here with author Malcolm Gladwell. His newest book is David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. He'll speak tonight to Arts and Letters Live at the McFarlane Auditorium at SMU. If you want to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you, the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Malcolm Gladwell. His book, David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants, is on store shelves now. He's in town to speak to Arts and Letters Live tonight at 7:30. That takes place at the McFarlane Auditorium at SMU. If you want to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Malcolm, what does all this research suggest to you about the perceived primacy of a country like the United States in the world?
Oh, that's interesting. Well, you know, it suggests, first of all, that the intuition that we have, I think, as a country, that there is some, you know, that as we get, that many, many years of being the wealthiest and most powerful country in the world has in some sense, weakened our fighting spirit. That intuition is not false. There's something to that. The kind of hunger that comes from being an underdog is a real phenomenon. You cannot help but be affected by years of being at the top. More importantly, though, it says this whole notion that giants are held to a different standard than everyone else. They're scrutinized in a way that, and sometimes I think we react to this double standard by saying, "Oh, that's unfair." And I guess it is a little bit unfair, but it's more. But I would say it is a fact that those in positions of real authority get held up to the light, and the way you act is, like I say, scrutinized more closely, and people will react much more vigorously to it and will hold you to what you say and all kinds of there's a burden.
Mm-hmm.
Was it heavy? Heavy, was it heavy lies the head that wears the crown?
Uneasy lies the head that wears
uneasy
the crown.
Lies the head that, that's it. And that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of what we've been going through for the last 30, 40 years in this country. So I would say that's very true, that both of those things are real reflections of the position America's in right now.
And in some ways, it does seem like the entire world gets it, right? I mean, we're criticized for being the world's police officer, and yet everybody needs us to be the world's police officer. And I'm speaking in general terms there. Mm-hmm. But people expect it. Other countries expect it, that criticize us for doing just that.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, the debate that comes to mind is the debate over torture.
Mm-hmm.
Should we be engaged in the business of torturing enemy combatants? And you could make a kind of, and people do make a very kind of pragmatic case that says, well, we need the kind of information that comes from those kinds of practices. You can also take a step back and say, wait a minute, if you're the most powerful country in the world, you can't do that because people hold you to a different and higher moral standard by virtue of your position and power and authority. And I'm very sensitive to that second argument now, having gone through the process of writing this book and looked. This chapter on the British and Northern Ireland is really fascinating. They go through exactly the same set of questions that we're going through in this country right now. They want to do things on a pragmatic basis to bring about order and peace in Northern Ireland. And they're constantly frustrated by the fact that people hold them to a higher standard and say, because you are England, and you've got to behave differently. You can't do the same things your opponent does. And in the end, the British ended up fighting a longer and more difficult battle because they did not heed that warning than they would have if they had kept their head up and from the beginning. I strongly believe that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Christine in Rowlett. Hi, Christine.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Fascinating show. My question is going to kind of segue back to education for a moment, if I may.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Was really thinking about my childhood, particularly elementary school. Parents never helped me with homework. I never thought about it. Kind of got beaten up with the grades a little bit. You finally figure out you have to study. I have a third grader. I sit down, go through every homework assignment with them. Is there research that shows that it's still advantageous to do that in elementary school, trying to instill good study habits? Or am I actually doing him a disadvantage by not letting him flounder and figuring out, hey, an F doesn't feel really good on that spelling test?
Yeah.
And I can take my question off air.
Thanks for
my answer.
Well, I am as always a little bit worried about giving advice about people's own children. I guess I would say it depends on the child. I mean, I'm dodging the answer, dodging the question by saying that. But it really does. I suppose I would say if you think your child is someone who is thoughtful enough and introspective enough to learn those kinds of lessons, then I would say absolutely back off. And a couple of Fs might not be a bad thing, particularly, you know, look, the stakes in third grade are not great. So that's precisely the time in a child's life where those kinds of real world experiments in, you know, in learning what the consequences of your own behavior are probably pretty useful. It's not like you're graduating from, you know, your graduate program in law when those kinds of mistakes have real consequences. So I would say at least try it and see what happens. But I do think that you've put your finger on the one thing that the current cultural climate around education has undervalued, which is self-reliance. That's the big thing. I think we're not realizing how crucial that is and building that is.
You've said, Malcolm, and I'm paraphrasing here, that essentially your goal is for your books to start conversations rather than answer every question. And I wonder if you began your career expecting that to be the case, or if you just realized that every article you wrote led you to 10,000 more questions than you could possibly answer within a piece of work.
I mean, I've always thought the role of journalists was to start to inform debate. That's what our job is. But you're right in the sense that the more I have, the more experience I've gotten and the more books I've written and the more things that I have sort of investigated, the more humbled I am by my own efforts and role. I don't think you can begin to settle some of these questions with one book. But I do think you can get, like the woman who just called, that's exactly the kind of question I want people to be asking when they read my books or encounter some of my books. Yeah, that's the question. When I help my child, am I undermining self-reliance or am I, you know, helping to build? That's a question every parent has got to grapple with. And that's what I see my role is simply prompting that kind of investigation. You can't hope to do more than that. I mean, any journalist who thinks they can resolve the great questions of the day has an ego much larger than mine.
Well, it does seem like this industry, and this is not exclusive to you, the way a lot of works of nonfiction are marketed, it's as if this is the answer to everything, and just take this tome and read it, and you have wisdom for a lifetime. You know, it's almost like sometimes people approach nonfiction as if the story is over after you've consumed this book.
Yeah, no, I very resistant to that trend. You know, I've described my own books as gateway drugs for more serious works of social science. And I think that's how I like to see them. My point is, what I want to do is to turn people on to these subjects so that they go and read more and investigate on their own. And, you know, Danny Kahneman wrote that book, Thinking Fast and Slow, which has done very well. And I've thought that, you know, some portion of the people who bought that book, which is a brilliant, serious investigation of how we make decisions, you know, I think there are some people who read my book, Blink, and got that turned them on to the subject, and so they were ready for the hard stuff, mm-hmm. right? And that's what that book's the hard stuff. It's heroin. My book was, you know, was candy cane. So that's how I see it. I hope I'm not shutting doors. I hope I'm opening them.
How do you decide where to go next? Are you like in the shower and suddenly you think, wait a second, I can think of three counterexamples to this thing that everyone thinks they know. I'm going to go find, you know, 100 research papers that back that up.
Yeah, well, a lot of it is kind of random. I mean, I just finished a story for The New Yorker. It hasn't run yet on Waco, on the Branch Davidians in Mount Carmel 20 years ago. And that was just something I've always been interested in. And then I went back. It turns out there's some fantastic books that have been written very recently on that. So I just did a kind of book review of these. That's just stuff I run across. And then recently, on the subject of education, I've been really interested in how do parents choose schools? So when a parent says, I'd like, you know, I'm buying a house in this neighborhood because I think it has great public schools, how do they reach the conclusion that that school is great? And that's a really interesting question because it turns out a lot of the measures that we use to measure, to decide whether a school is great, have nothing to do with the school's quality. Hmm. They're irrelevant. Trying to figure out how should you judge a school's quality is a totally fascinating question. That's sort of something I want to investigate in the near term.
I would imagine you get into that sunk cost fallacy too, right? Like after you've put down the money to buy a house in a particular neighborhood, suddenly you're really invested in that being the best school ever.
Yeah. Well, a lot of what we mean by how good a school is how many good students attend that school, mm-hmm. Which is a very, very different question than whether the school is good. But more particularly, whether a school is good for your child.
Yeah.
Right? Very different question. So a lot of it is reframing the question so that it answers what you want answered. So do you mean, what is the school that has the greatest teachers? Or maybe you do want to send your kid to a school that has the greatest number of other high-performing students. That's legitimate, I suppose, but that's a different matter than which school has the best teachers or which school has the most diverse undergrad, you know, a student population, or any number of other ways in which you could make that choice.
I guess it could also lead you into some really disconcerting territory in terms of socioeconomic background and racial and ethnic background and makeup of the school.
Exactly. What I would like people to do is to be honest. So I think a lot of when people say that, what they're saying is, what school has the greatest number of children who most resemble my child ethnically and socioeconomically? There's nothing, you know, people should be free to make that choice, but I would like them to be honest about it. Don't pretend that they're making a choice for other reasons. Let's be clear about what we're doing in society when we make these highly consequential decisions.
So we were talking about this a bit before the show. You are an avid runner. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, do you have headphones in when you're running, or is that thinking time for you?
No, I'm old school. Runners, you know, the old school guys like me, and I'm ancient now, we run without any, we don't have anything in our ears. We commune with our own thoughts when we run. I daydream and I think about stuff I'm working on. And I think, you know, I thought about this a lot. The one thing that is missing from, one of the things that's missing from the world we live in is opportunities for solitude and reflection. There are precious few times when you are alone with your thoughts. And if you're someone who relies on your thoughts for your job, and that, by the way, that describes most of the modern workplace.
Or it should.
It should. You got to create time for that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have time for reflection, I think you're at a tremendous disadvantage. And running is my time for reflection.
It's strange that it's made to feel selfish to have time for thinking. And like, if you're off exercising, then that's a bona fide. Like that's a activity that people approve of. And so you can say, I'm going to be gone for 90 minutes.
Yeah. No, it's funny. Growing up, my father was a mathematician, and he needed a huge amount of time for reflection. And my mother always made it very plain to us that when my father was doing something solitary, we needed to respect that was his job, even when he was digging in the garden or mm-hmm. going for a walk with the dog. If you wanted to go for a walk with him, you walked in silence so that he could. And I thought that was something very beautiful about that. And I learned to treasure my moments of silence with my father. Those are some of the greatest memories of my life. So I think it's something we just need to reintroduce into our culture.
My guest this hour has been author Malcolm Gladwell. His newest book is called David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. He's in town to speak tonight to Arts and Letters Live. That happens at 7:30 at the McFarlane Auditorium, at SMU. And you'll be speaking, and then is there like a Q&A and a signing at the same
There'll
time?
There'll be a signing, and I'm going to be speaking about something that's not in the book but related to it. It's a wholly new some brand new stuff I've been thinking about.
Perfect. Well, I know lots of people are looking forward to it. Thank you so much for being with
Thank
us.
Thank you, Chris.
Today's show, Think, is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.